You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
We welcome Runjay Gulati back to the podcast. Runjay is the Paul R. Lawrence MBA Class of 1942 Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. His title is almost as long as mine. He last joined us to talk about his book, Deep Purpose. And this time we're going to be discussing his fantastic new book, How to Be Bold, The Surprising Science of Everyday Courage. You're really going to enjoy the pod.
Runjay, always a pleasure.
Yeah, it's so good to see you.
Yes, same here.
All right. I love this book, and I know it's not going to surprise you that I saw all sorts of connections to my field of improvisation, some of which you explicitly name. But I have to know first, how does one get the holiness, get His Holiness the Dalai Lama to write the foreword to one's book? Is that a text? Is that a phone call?
Be bold.
I bet that is a bold ask, my friend.
You know, sometimes you don't, you know, you don't ask to ask. I just wanted to get the book to him.
Yeah.
You know, I thought of people I just had to get, I got an email address for his office.
So it was an email.
It was an email. Yeah.
Okay.
And it wasn't with an ask necessarily. It was no ask per se. It was just like, you know, want you to see this book. But I think is, you know, I didn't hear back for a couple of months. So
sure.
It was, I thought like, yeah. And then, you know, it was a beautiful foreword. Mm-hmm. I hope people will read it. It was a little awkward because I thought there was more wisdom in that one page than there was in the whole book.
Well,
so put me in a bit of a jam there. But I, you know, look, you know what it tells us is that at one level, courage is everywhere.
Yeah.
And yet it's so hard to kind of find people who epitomize courage over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes courage doesn't mean kind of taking violent upheaval action. It means standing in your place.
Yeah. Well, all right. So I think what's amazing about that is the way you then start the book where you, in the introduction, you talk about one of the most courageous people you know, and it's your mom. And so can you tell a little bit about her story?
Yeah, you know, I honestly had buried that story because I don't look good in that story. So it was like maybe there was a selective suppression on my own part. The publisher was like, you got to talk about you. And I'm like, oh, but I don't know about me. You know, I'm a professor. What am I supposed to write about? I'm not a Marine or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember this story from when I was 14 years old. My mother, who was a pretty gutsy person to begin with, you know, she was a school teacher, turned anthropologist, turned fashion designer with a couple of top fashion houses in Europe. And she built this stuff from scratch out of nothing. And in a very male dominated society, which was India at the time. And then because 1972, she'd gone to Paris with two suitcases going door to door to fashion houses to convince them to buy her designs. So anyway, this thing takes off. She's very successful. I'm in boarding school. I come back one weekend. And the guard from the gate comes to me and says, there's somebody out there insisting on seeing your mom. Could you just talk to him? Because he's not leaving. And it was a weekend. And so I went out to talk to this guy. He's a big, burly guy. He's come from the developer who wants to buy this piece of land that my mother has bought where she's going to build her design studio and her home.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, look, don't waste your time. She's not going to sell the land. He says, no, I want just 5 minutes with her. We'll stop bothering her after that. So I go in and talk to my mom, and he's asking for 5 minutes. She says, okay, fine, send him in. She's sitting in the living room. So I bring him in, and I'm standing at the door to kind of like, I figure he's leaving soon anyway. I'll walk him out. He sits down very politely, and he takes out a piece of paper and a checkbook with a blank check signed and says, look, ma'am, we want to buy your land. You just put the amount in there, whatever amount you want to put. My mother says, look, I don't want to sell the land. There's no other land in the area, and I want to have my home and studio there. So, and I don't care about the money. So thank you very much. He immediately gets more belligerent and aggressive, saying, I am not leaving here without your signature. You have to sign this. My mother says, please leave right away now. And I am absolutely not signing this document. So please leave. So at this point, he leans back and he's wearing a blazer, and he pulls his blazer back, and he's got a gun tucked in there. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm at the door. I freeze up.
Sure.
I'm thinking, what should I do? Should I call the guard? Should I jump him? Maybe he's bluffing. Don't want to provoke the guy. How big is he? How big am I? Can I take him on? All this, I'm just standing there like my mother, 5 foot 1 inches tall, without hesitation, leaps out of her sofa seat, walks around, and slaps him across the face. He didn't even see it coming. And I can tell you from personal experience, that must have hurt.
Yeah.
And he is stunned. She starts, says, how dare you come into my house and threaten me and then try to bully me into selling my land? Get out of here. Now, that was a brilliant strategic move, because in the commotion, he was off guard.
Yeah.
And the security guard heard the noise and came running in. Mm-hmm. This guy ran out of there so fast, he forgot his checkbook. I asked her afterwards, I said, Mom, that was crazy. Didn't you see he had a gun? Weren't you scared? And she said something to me that always stuck in my head. She said, just because you're scared doesn't mean you do nothing. Mm-hmm. And it made me realize in that brief encounter that courage is not the absence of fear. Courage is taking action in the face of fear. It's learning to face into your fear rather than succumb to your fear. Now, fast forward, I do research into that. I realize that fear is a primal human emotion, hardwired in the primitive human brain, in the amygdala. It's a survival emotion. There's, in fact, a great book called The Gift of Fear. How fear held... Kelly, I'm sorry, but our ancestors were all cowards. They're the ones who survived.
Yeah.
The ones who ran to danger didn't have kids.
No.
Didn't make it. So survival, self-preservation is baked into our DNA. And fear is the way it is the alert system for us. So if we're going to be courageous, we have to learn to deal with the discomfort of fear. And the Wizard of Oz, you know, lion goes to the wizard, says, give me courage. And the wizard says, but you already have courage.
Yeah.
He's like, but I'm scared. Now, I've come to realize that a big culprit in this whole thing is modern day myth making. Not modern day, I should say. Ancient even. Mm-hmm. Myth making about the heroic characters. From ancient Greek mythology to present day Hollywood and Bollywood and fiction writing and detective writing, we have these mythic characters. James Bond, Jason Bourne, Rambo. Mm-hmm. You know, these kind of fearless people who are numb to fear. And we think of that, the mental association is courage is the absence of fear. It's not. Most courageous people I talk to experience fear. Even, I'll give you an example, Tom Cruise, who does most of his own stunts.
Mm-hmm.
Right, was asked after the last Mission Impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Where he drove a motorcycle off a cliff. Mm-hmm. 6 times. He was asked, "Weren't you scared?" And he said, "You know, absolutely, I'm scared, but I'm okay with being scared." So that's the premise of this book. How do we learn to be okay with being scared? How do we deal with the discomfort of fear and still go ahead and do something?
Yeah. I remember when I first started here at Second City, so this is in the late 80s, there was still a lot of the founders were around, and there was a lot of mythology and a phrase that was that Del Close, who's one of the sort of founding mentors of Second City, he used to say, "Follow the fear," and I loved it. Right, it was a very attractive idea. Decades later, it's a bit of a misnomer in terms of what you're saying, because what we teach people is exactly what you're saying, is the fear is always going to be there. You're just going to work through it. You're going to use it. But it does not go away. So it's through sort of repetition and practice that you get better at, okay, I'm going to feel okay walking out on the stage in front of 300 people with nothing. Because what you then are taught is you have more than nothing. You have your five other cast members. You have the whole life you've lived. You have all these things that at your disposal. And as I'm reading through your book, and I'm just sort of like, oh, this is it's very similar, which seems odd, right? In one case, because we were talking about these life and death situations, and I'm talking about a bunch of people, improv comedians. But I think that's where we meet. I think there's bravery to be found everywhere.
Kelly, I don't want to. Physical courage is one thing, but the fear of being judged is sometimes even more acute for some people. So to be standing up there, I mean, as somebody, I don't do improv, so just to get that out there, but public speaking, you do. Yeah, you know, and the fear of being judged in a negative way is really a powerful, you know, immobilizer, you know, and it's interesting, Adele, the famous singer, how they resource themselves. So this is, I give you an example. Adele actually has a ritual. She looks at a picture of Celine Dion before she performs. Mm. Katie Ledecky, the famous Olympic athlete, she recites her grandmother's name to calm herself down. Mm-hmm. You know, all the tennis players, all the athletes have calming systems because, you know, one is to calm, and that's one of my C's, is what are the systems and ways to calm the emotions down, dampen the fear response. You know, if you look at Simone Biles and how she overcame the twisties, took her 3 years to really deal with that. But what are the mechanisms available? To me, the starting point that was interesting, how have humans dealt with this from ancient times? And one of the foundational things we've done since ancient times was a belief in a higher power. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not making a religious statement here at all, and I am myself, you know, a believer in a higher power. But it also is a tremendously comforting thing. It dampens our fear. So it's no surprise that in difficult times, if you look at even the most ancient cave dwellers, in the drawings on the walls, you see them praying to a higher power. Now, that raises a question, what activates fear? Mm-hmm. Where does fear originate? So we talked about two anecdotes. One is physical danger. One is this kind of standing on stage. But if you want to know the root of fear, the root of fear is uncertainty.
Right.
Uncertainty is not the same as risk. Uncertainty is I don't know. Risk is I know and I can model this and 10% chance of this and that. So, you know, versus uncertainty, I don't know. Because uncertainty activates in the brain the loss of control.
Right.
Early days of COVID, the great financial crisis, when we see, and even today, so the latest Harvard Business Review cover issue is about courage. Hmm. And what do they say? We're facing an uncertainty crisis today. So when the human, in ancient times, cave dwellers, they had lots of weather uncertainty, disease uncertainty, neighboring kingdom uncertainty, political land uncertainty. There was all kinds of uncertainty. And so they found solace or dampening their fear by believing in something bigger than themselves. And that was a coping system. You know, today you have people in modern day finance go the other extreme of hyper-rationality. I'm going to analyze the hell out of this data. I believe I can turn uncertainty into risk. Not true, but, you know, at least I comfort myself and I kid myself into, I delude myself into believing that I got it. So turning uncertainty to risk is another kind of play we do. But similarly, I was trying to understand how do people resource themselves so they are able to move through fear.
So can we talk about risk hunting? Because I think this felt to me almost the most improvisational thing that in the book, because this idea of taking agency is, as I think what you're talking about there, overturning the uncertainty into risk by going risk hunting. And I'd never heard the term before.
So that was the idea that, in the modern day human being, there is sometimes a belief that I can, it's a beautiful thing. Nothing is insurmountable, but also everything is analyzable. I just need to get more data. I am a quant jock and I can quant and modify, model everything. That I can turn uncertainty into risk. It's not true again, but it's at least a self-comforting strategy. There was a great book called Radical Uncertainty by John Kay and Merv King, one of them being the governor of Bank of England, former governor of Bank of England. And they actually chastised modern-day finance, saying that modern finance likes to pretend, at least to the investors whose money is being put at risk, that it's not uncertainty, it's risk. Trust me, we got it. No one wants to say, I don't know. Who's going to say, I don't know, give me your money? Right? So I think their argument is that we take it too far sometimes, that we take this risk hunting idea too far. But nonetheless, it definitely is a play. I mean, I talk about Philip Pettit over there, this guy who does high wire walks. He did one across the Grand Canyon. He didn't just do it. He spent a decade studying the weather patterns and winds and a whole bunch of things before he did it. So the idea is that, we have to find ways to dampen the fear response or even the inherent uncertainty we're dealing with. Having said that, you can never get rid of uncertainty. Not today. And so you're not going to get rid of fear. Not today. So you're going to have to still make that leap of faith. And that leap of faith is going to require some courage. I mean, if you're an AI investor today, are you going to do it or not do it? Mm-hmm. Right? If your company needs AI to transform the way it operates, are you going to do it or not do it? Right? If you're thinking about tariff uncertainty and trying to figure out your supply chains and where should you relocate or locate, do it or not do it? I don't know. You have to figure that out too. Right? As we are dealing with kind of political and geopolitical challenges, the question is, how do I navigate through that? Right? And I think even as we think about our own careers, if jobs are going to change in a fundamental transfer in a way, what is that going to mean for me? How do I navigate and think about my career? And honestly, writing this book was a scary thought for me because it was not in a genre that I've written for before. Right? I mean, I'm a business professor. I study organizations. And here I was kind of, and there's no literature per se on courage. I had to look here in psychology, a bit in neuroscience, a bit in sociology, and I'm trying to piece it together. But I had to kind of deal with it. I'm like, hey, if I'm writing about being bold, I better be bold myself.
Right. About 10 years ago, when I started this part of my journey, which was, I've worked in improvisation on stage. Now I'm interested in improvisation off stage. I'm interested in the science around this. There was basically one guy who had what was seemingly good literature about improvisation. That's Carl Weick. And he had studied this improvised actions of people on flight carriers, but also disaster relief and those sorts of things. And I'd love for you to talk about the Fukushima power plants. This is a 2011 earthquake in Japan, and two different plants where people behaved differently, and one resulted in disaster and the other disaster averted.
Yeah. So again, you picked on also one of my favorites as well, which is Carl Weick's work on sense making. Let me put a preamble to it. When Aristotle wrote his essay about courage, he was talking about the ideal soldier. And he put a continuum over there, and he said on the one extreme is cowardice, on the other extreme is reckless. Uh-huh. And he put courage in the middle. Uh-huh. Now here's where Carl Weick kicks into it, because Carl's idea is playing in the middle, which is you don't leap into the unknown. You work your way into the unknown. In fact, the idea is most people want to know before they act. And Carl's point was sometimes you have to act your way into knowing. Mm-hmm. You have to take small steps so you can learn versus knowing before acting. And this was a key premise of what Carl was trying to talk about here. Now, how does this fit into a story that I documented in the case? So I read a short article in The Economist many years ago where it was talking about the Fukushima crisis. Everyone says Fukushima is like one place. There were actually two crises. The Fukushima Daiichi plant, which had a meltdown, and the Fukushima Daini plant that was also going to have a meltdown but didn't.
Yep.
Both are 8 miles away on the coastline. Both had 20-foot high boundary walls to protect against water. The tsunami brought to both the plants 55-foot high waves. So the entire plant was, both the plants were submerged, right? Meaning the cooling systems, everything was submerged in water, which shut everything down. Now, the one thing you know in a nuclear reactor is if you don't get the cooling system back up, I think it's a matter of like 48 hours or so that you're going to have a meltdown. Both plants had the same kind of deadline. The Fukushima Daiichi plant, unfortunately, was not able to stop. It gets the cooling system back up, and we had a meltdown and took the whole world, sending ships and all to contain that, barely able to contain that meltdown, and it's going to take 25 years to clean up. Mm-hmm. Down the road, 8 miles away, you have the same situation unfolding. They are able to get their cooling system back up, avert a meltdown, which would have been a global catastrophe. So what does Masuda-san do? Now Hiro Masuda-san, what does he do? He first puts up a whiteboard in the room, in the emergency room, where there are 300 people scared, don't know if their families are alive out there, and don't know what to do. He's called TEPCO headquarters, the utility company, and they say, we don't know what to do. He called GE, they say, we don't know what you can do, just get the cooling system back up. So he puts a whiteboard and says, guys, what do we know? And he puts down that they have so many hours to get this thing back up and running. They know that the whole thing is submerged. They know that there is no power. And they know that they got to get power back up somehow. And they also know there are some cables laying around in the complex here and there. Maybe they can build an extension cord from wherever there's power to the reactor. This is not like rocket science.
Yeah.
He then asks for some volunteers. Everyone volunteers. He picks five, sends them out to find out what's going on around. They come back and report. He updates. He sends more groups out. And what he's doing is slowly by one, they're gathering information and evaluating their options, building some hypotheses, testing the hypotheses, negating the hypothesis, building new hypotheses. And in that process, they crack it. And the other example Carl Weick uses is firefighters who go into a building. They don't run in and charge in. They methodically, step by step, work their way into it. And at every step, they're gathering more data, revising hypotheses. So courage is not just like, think firefighter. You work your way in. Think ancient navigators, mariners who used to navigate point to point. They didn't just set sail in the middle of the Atlantic or Pacific. They'd find the nearest landmass. They even take a circuitous route. So they were going landmass to landmass to landmass to landmass. So I think that's what you got to do. Act your way into knowing.
I think what's also amazing about that story is this idea where you're tapping into the collective genius of the room, everyone's opinions. But at a certain point, as a leader, you have to stop, and then you lead and act. And if you don't, it's kind of crucial, because if you don't have that, then you're rudderless. And it reminded me a little bit of, and this is in my book, Yes, Anna, Tell the Story, where we are doing a workshop for the Spertus Institute of Jewish Learning. And the guy who ran that entity was an expert in Jewish leadership. And we're leading the exercise called Follow the Follower. And essentially this improv exercise is someone is secretly told they're the leader in the group. You can't use words, but you're going to walk around the room. The whole group's going to walk around. And that person who's the leader has to give that leadership to someone else. And they have to receive it. And so on. And as we're doing this, he hits me and he's like, you're doing Peter Drucker. And I'm like, I don't know what that means. And then I sort of realize after I do my research on Peter Drucker, I'm like, oh, this is an interesting thing about this is not top-down leadership. That is not what we do. But it doesn't mean that there is no leadership, because there's absolutely leadership.
Absolutely. That's a great observation, Kelly. And I think that there's a subtlety over there between leading and being led and being understood. People want to have voice, but they also want to be led. And, you know, in fact, the 2/3 of my book is about individual courage. The last 1/3 is about collective courage. And in that collective courage section, I talk about this, that what does the great leaders do? How do they lead for courage? And you touched on a very important point, which is they are inclusive and directive at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I mean, that's just, it's not how we think. You know, we're always trying to do ABC, you know, and it's got would be one thing or another. And it's like, I think it's many things. All right. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a thank you because story. But before we do that, I actually really like William Swann's work. I had not heard of this term identity fusion. So I'd love you to talk about what that is.
So it's a delicate one, and I think it's important to understand. In some organizations, you become so attached to the organization, it almost becomes an extension of yourself, meaning it feels personal. You may see that in some startups where founders experience that. For them, it's like their baby, as they say, but it's not the founder only. Some of the early joiners feel the same way, right? And it's this kind of deep sense of connection that you feel. Now, you may say, Ranjay, are you describing a cult to me over here? Because in the early days of Nike, people got their, they would get the swoosh tattooed on their bodies.
Yeah.
Right? So this is like serious identity fusion here. So identity is what? How we see ourselves. And fusion means I see myself as this thing, as I see myself as an extension of this collective. I'm so deeply enmeshed with the collective. Now, what is interesting is I found that the great courageous organizations, they don't subsume the individual into a cult. They actually create place for the individual to be the individual. So it's this fine balance between individual and collective. You know, where you are deeply connected, but you also experience a sense that I'm an individual. So I saw this in many companies where, you know, you have strong attachments to the collective, but you also experience strong sense of autonomy that I am being allowed to be me. You know, Netflix is a great example of that, where, you know, people have attachment to the collective, but they also have a strong individuality that, you know, you can be or do whatever you want to do. The place I saw this the best was actually Pete Carroll's team, at that time the Seahawks. And what Pete would do is he wanted people to feel like they were not just transactional objects playing for themselves so they could make more money. That too, he paid them well. But he said, I wanted to create attachment to the team, because when people are connected to the collective, they will do more. Think Ted Lasso, you know? Yeah. That's a great illustration of that. I love Ted Lasso show. But the most profound example of this was the Native Americans. And I heard this from an individual who is has followed this very carefully. The Native American tribes had a concept they used to call the long body. And the long body was within the tribe, people were so connected to each other that if one of them was in danger far away, the others could feel that danger. They sensed it. You may say, Ranjay, you're really out there. You're far out there. I don't know what you're talking about. You're a scientist or what? Mm-hmm. Now, whether it's true or not is irrelevant. The point is how they felt.
Right.
They felt so connected to each other. They said, I can feel your danger. Even if they did or didn't. Maybe it was inaccurate. There were so many false positives and false negatives. We don't know. Okay? But the idea is that people feeling so deeply connected to others. And I've seen that in organizations when people talk about the organization where they're employed, some will talk about it in very personal terms. But in this kind of identity fusion, it's not like, oh, I'm nobody, I'm just a worker bee in this system. It's because they feel I'm allowed to be me and I'm also part of the collective. And that delicate balance, I think, is very, very hard, but I think it's very powerful because it elicits, when I feel that the collective is part of me, I will go to great limits. Another example I use is the Marine Corps. Semper Fidelis, always faithful. And by the way, in that context, people said to me, you are more scared of letting your teammates down than you are of dying.
Right.
It's relative fear. So, how to create this kind of collective mindset. I use the example of the Taj Hotel in India, mm-hmm. where during a terrorist attack, not a single one of the employees ran away. They all were focused on the customer, making sure that the guests in the hotel were safe. So sometimes, you know, I think we need to recognize that we do a lot for ourselves. Self-interest is very powerful. But attachment to collective, something that we believe in, is sometimes even more powerful.
I was having this conversation yesterday. I was being interviewed on someone else's podcast, and I said, it's always interested me that I work at this soon-to-be 66-year-old institution, which is got a philosophy it teaches all its performers, which is that you put your focus on the other person, you make your partner look good, and all we do is produce individual stars. And I kind of love that. It is true. Their success is because of that focus, that mindset, that belief in the ensemble, and it does not preclude them their individual success. In some ways, it almost guarantees it.
Beautiful. And I think that's the idea: is that how do we now? The question, Kelly, is how do we take this to scale?
Yeah.
You know, we talk about boundaries, work-life boundaries and this boundary. You know, most of us experience work as disconnected from our life, what we call work-life balance. Mm-hmm. And yet, what if work felt personal? Mm-hmm. What if work was an extension of me? How would I engage with what I'm doing? Would I be more courageous? Would my organization experience more courage because of how everyone was so bought into the collective? You see this a lot in early stage startups, by the way. It's mm-hmm. so manifest. It goes away as these organizations scale, but it's very energizing and exciting to see how people are willing to go to great lengths for the collective.
Well, one of the things I've noticed about the reason people in startups and theater kids get along is because we've had to do the same thing, which is if you're a theater kid, you're going to put on a show and then you figure out like, oh, I got to sell tickets. I'm going to need to make a program. I need to make sets. Actors have to learn their lines. I have to do all that. And when you're in a startup, you're kind of doing everything from scratch. And that is, unless you've done that before, there's no, how would you have any practice in it? You know, so,
yeah.
It's a unique thing. Okay. We always end the podcast for returning guests, asking them for a thank you because story, which is our technique for how we try to move forward in a world where we're in difference with people. Do you have one of those for us?
Well, I am thankful to my thank you because of my close friends who I feel give me tremendous support. Mm-hmm. And I want to explain what I mean by that support. When others believe in you, you start to believe in yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think having a close group of friends and family that believes in me gives me courage to go forward and do whatever I want, do what I need to do and want to do. And I'm thankful for that. And thank you to each of them.
Wow. That's beautiful. The book is called How to Be Bold, The Surprising Science of Everyday Courage. Ranjay Gulati, thank you so much.
Pleasure, Kelly, as always. Wow. Really a pleasure. We had such a nice conversation last time, and you haven't disappointed again, so you're only getting better.
Thank God. All right, thanks.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.